Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am John Milford, Chair of the Club's Grown Ups Forum and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to listen to us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Mark Friedman is CEO and founder of Encore.org, a nonprofit organization working to promote Encore careers, second acts for the greater good. He spearheaded the creation of the Experience Corps, now one of America's largest nonprofit national service programs engaging people over 55, and the Purpose Prize, which annually provides five $100,000 prizes to social innovators in the second half of life. Friedman was described by the New York Times as the voice of aging baby boomers who are eschewing retirement for meaningful and sustaining work later in life. While the Wall Street Journal stated, in the past decade, Mr. Friedman has emerged as a leading voice in discussions nationwide about the changing face of retirement. He's the author of The Big Shift, Navigating the New Stage Beyond Midlife, published in April 2011, which the New York Times called an imaginative work with the potential to affect our individual lives and our collective future. Recognized by Fast Company magazine 3 years in a row as one of the nation's leading social entrepreneurs, Friedman is widely published and quoted in the national media and has been honored with numerous awards and fellowships. Friedman has an MBA from Yale University, was a visiting research fellow at King's College, University of London. He lives with his wife and children in the San Francisco Bay Area. And now join me in greeting Mark Friedman.
Thank you, John, and thanks so much to all of you for coming out at the end of a work day to talk about the future of work. I read a quote from Joseph Campbell 4 years ago. He said that midlife is when you get to the top of the ladder and discover it's leaning against the wrong wall. And that quote shook me up, and it made me think about the wall that my ladder was leaning against. I'd spent 20 years at that point focused on trying to create more opportunities for people in the second half of life to improve the circumstances of kids through the Experience Corps that John Milford mentioned and other efforts. And I felt like it was the right purpose in life, but I was flagging at that time. I read a second quote around the same period, and it was one from Mary Catherine Bateson, the daughter of Margaret Mead, who said that we'd stretched midlife so long it had become like a run-on sentence in desperate need of punctuation. And I decided I didn't really need to change walls so much as I needed to get a little bit of that punctuation. A comma was probably too little. The semicolon, that's what I needed in my life, was a semicolon. And I went to my board of directors and I asked them if I could take a sabbatical. And they happily agreed. I think maybe they were feeling that I was flagging a little bit as well. And I began making very grand plans. In fact, I decided to go to the opposite end of the earth, to Australia, and to take a big trip for 3 months with my wife and our two young children. And I began the process of accumulating guidebooks to Sydney and Melbourne and the Outback, and that pile started growing higher as the days leading up to the trip began growing shorter. And finally, I reached a point where I realized I had absolutely no desire to go to Australia and spend 3 months in a hotel room with two screaming children, then 2 and 4 years old. In fact, the sabbatical was what you had to do to recover from the trip with the kids in the hotel room. And so I called up United Airlines. I'd cashed in all my frequent flyer miles to take this big extravaganza, and for a mere $1,000, they let me have my miles back and let me stay at home. And I, instead of feeling like my dreams in life had been dashed, my one opportunity to do the big getaway, I felt a huge sense of relief come over me. There'd be no airport security lines, no 14-hour flights, no coming back 3 months later to long piles of emails and correspondence and all of those kinds of things. And I was telling this to a friend because I was amazed that I'd had that reaction. And she said, oh, yeah, there actually was now a body of research in psychology that showed that one of the great pleasures in life is to plan a fantastic trip and then not go on it. But I felt like, well, you got to do something. After all, you know, I'd crossed this great midlife divide, and so I decided to take a car trip with the family up to Portland. Began planning again, collecting more guidebooks, looking at Google Maps, and I realized I couldn't make it all the way up to Portland in one drive, and so I'd have to stop in Medford. Got on the internet, started shopping for rates, and found a Homewood Suites in Medford, called them up, and having lost $1,000 not going to Australia, I thought, well, I should try to get a discount on this room, and I ran through the AAA rate, and finally I found the big discount, AARP. I'd gotten my card. This is my first chance to actually use it. I got off the phone, told my wife that I'd saved us $14. She still remembered the $1,000 we were out from not going to Australia, and she asked me, had I remembered to get the two cribs? So I called the 18-year-old at the check-in desk back and said, hey, this is Mr. Friedman. I just talked to you. Said, Mr. Senior Citizen Discount, that's me. Can I have two cribs? And in that moment, I realized that I had entered confusing territory, what might be called the oxymoronic years. Remember that time in grade school when you learned about onomatopoeias and oxymorons, the little giant, these contradictions in terms? But if you think about the way we treat people who are moving into this stage of life, right, 60 is the new 40. At the same time, if you go to my pharmacy in Berkeley on Solano Avenue, they give you senior citizen discounts at 60. So 60 is the old 80. At the same time, it's the new 40. And we hear about the young old, the working retired. Newsweek had a cover story a year or two ago about aging boomers reentering the workforce, and they describe them as the walking dead. So pretty much every contradiction in terms, every split difference, every kind of oxymoron has been invoked to describe this period at a personal level. And that same kind of contradiction and confusion is true more broadly societally, right? The longevity revolution, this vast expansion in life expectancy over the last century, you know, we've increased in 100 years average life expectancy in an amount that was equivalent to all the increases up to 1900. So this is a remarkable triumph. And at the same time, if you pick up the editorial pages, all you hear about is the gray tsunami, this long gray wave of greedy geezers soon to take America to the cleaners, the age quake. It's almost as if the Weather Channel has sponsored the entire demographic revolution. So how is it that the best thing that ever happened to us as individuals, these longer, healthier lives that we're leading and projected to lead even more in a more extended way in the future, turns out to be the worst thing to that happens to us as a society, right? You go to your doctor, and what do they tell you? Eat your cruciferous vegetables and walk around the block, reduce stress, live well so you can live long. And yet it seems if you pick up any of the New York Times issues over the last couple of months, you see old versus young. We see the great coming trade-off, all of these tremendously difficult zero-sum scenarios that are supposedly going to be the hallmark of our future. And not only that, demography is supposedly destiny, that it's inevitably so. So this confusion at an individual level, this longevity paradox more broadly, it's no surprise that in that context that you start seeing some desperate prescriptions. The book Boomsday by Christopher Buckley a couple of years ago proposed euthanasia for boomers at 70. Their families got green stamps and gifts and all in exchange for people willingly going to the great beyond. The most recent version, a little bit less stark, is in the movie The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, which I suspect many of you have seen, a film which is built around the proposition of outsourcing the elderly, right? If we can't figure out how to have a society with so many more people over the age of 60, well, let's just send them someplace else. And, I mean, after all, it's less expensive to live in places like India where the stars of the movie end up going. I'm here today to talk about an alternative to either euthanasia or outsourcing what soon will be a quarter of the population, and to argue that the solution to much that ails us as individuals and as a society lays in rethinking the map of life, a map of life that was in many ways set up for 70 for those what seemed like longer lives of the past century, but is inadequate to the 50 lifespans that more and more people will be living in the 21st century. Half the kids born since 2000 in the developed world are projected to see their 100th birthday. So we can't just fold, spindle, mutilate, stretch, and extend this life course that really was set up for a very different arc of life to one that that is really that has an extra decimal point, an extra zero to it. And so I think what's happening, to really cut to the essence of what I'm saying today, is that the nature of life is under every bit as radical a transformation as the numbers are, all those numbers that we're so familiar with, and that the period that's been characterized in these oxymoronic terms is actually an entirely new stage of life. 60 is not the new 40, it's not the old 80, 60 is the new 60. And these tens of millions of people who are flooding into this territory are something entirely new on the landscape, and yet something that's poorly recognized, seen mostly as a problem to be solved, but I think may well amount to being an opportunity to be seized if we play our cards right. But this whole proposition, at one level, probably sounds counterintuitive. Life stages seem like natural phenomena, like the oxygen in the air, fixtures, when in fact they're much closer to being fictions. I learned that in trying to trace and understand the history of retirement in America, this idea of the golden years that has seemed so much a core part of the American dream for the last half century. In fact, if you go back even to the 1930s when Social Security was invented, 65 was picked as the eligibility age for Social Security based on the Prussian military pension of the 19th century that Otto von Bismarck had selected as an eligibility age of 65, convinced the state would never pay out a single pension. He was, I think, in his late 70s at the time. And in the 30s, we picked this age, gave out the first Social Security check in January of 1940 to a woman named Ida Mae Fuller in Vermont, who put $20.75 into the system and proceeded to live to just shy of her 101st birthday, reaping $22,888.92 in the process. She saw the Beatles come to America and the moon landing. And not that everybody at that point was going to live these ripe, long 21st century lifespans, but the handwriting was already on the wall. In fact, by the late 1940s, Walter Reuther, the great UAW leader, described retirees as too old to work, too young to die, which turned out to be a problem for those individuals who were trying to figure out what to do during these extended spans beyond their working years, but also for the financial services industry, which was having a hard time convincing people to invest in a period that was a dreaded time, a period where people hardly wanted to think about, talk about, definitely did not look forward to or think about investing in. And so they began selling retirement as a kind of aristocratic period where people could go to the ball game in the afternoon. And that vision wasn't cemented until the early 1960s, particularly by the retirement community developers. My hero from that period is a guy by the name of Delbert E. Webb. I'm sure you've heard of him. Del Webb, the inventor of Sun City, the first large-scale retirement community in the country, who took a flyer on this idea that later life could be a second childhood. Graying is playing. And he built a community, invested $2 million in late 1950s, early 1960s dollars into the opening of Sun City. And there was a wonderful moment the night before the community actually opened when one of his lieutenants was sitting around a table at a Mexican restaurant in Peoria, Arizona. And he said, how am I ever going to sell a 30-year mortgage to somebody who's 65 years old? And they realized, oh, maybe we should have thought about that beforehand. And they all had sleepless nights. Then they awoke the next day, and 100,000 people showed up. If you build it, they will come. There was this inchoate longing for something different than what society offered at this stage of life. And they essentially managed to make what was seen as a necessity, a virtue, and retirement, this idea of the golden years for an extended period in the last part of life, became a hallmark of the American dream. And it's not just retirement that was invented in the last century. Even adolescence, the idea of youth, was concocted in the early part of the century. That word was coined in 1904 by a 60-year-old, a psychologist named G. Stanley Hall, because we were at a situation in the country where there was a proliferation of the neither nors of that day. You know, I was talking earlier about neither young nor old as the characteristic of so many of us in our 50s, 60s, 70s. Well, there were all these young people who were no longer children, but they weren't quite adults. It was a time when there was a lot of disruption in the country, urbanization, industrialization, immigration. There was concern about all these young people who had physical maturity, but not emotional maturity. And so we essentially created a moratorium period for them. We invented high schools and child labor laws. And it took 40 years until 1944 when we invented the word teenager with the birth of 17 magazine. So there's, you know, there's some irony in that youth was invented by somebody in their 60s. But the main lesson really is that these stages of life were essentially responses to problems. They were solutions. And it's ironic that it was G. Stanley Hall himself, the inventor of youth, who proposed 20 years later a new stage of life between midlife and old age, arguing that he had actually made a mistake. He should have invented this stage for people like himself. He promptly passed away a year later, but he, in writing about this period, he had a set of beautiful images and insights, which I think actually make a lot of sense almost 100 years later. He described this period as an Indian summer, and he said that human beings didn't reach the height of their capacity until the shadows started slanting eastward, which I love. And essentially his idea was that more and more people were reaching a point where they had the benefits of experience and the capacity to actually do something with it. Mary Catherine Bateson, who I invoked earlier, wrote a book a couple of years ago, Composing a Further Life, in which she described the key traits of this period as active wisdom. And I think it all comes back to a sense of time. You know, the familiar way of thinking about this period in life and the assets that people have as they move into their encore careers and continue trying to contribute to society is experience, essentially time lived. I think just as important is the other side, is the question of time left to live. Because, you know, I know when I hit my 50s and I find this theme over and over again when I talk to other people, there's a recognition that there are a lot fewer years ahead than there are behind. That's just the reality, even in this era of much longer lifespans. And that has a profound impact on people's priorities, on their perspective. And yet at the same time, there's this awareness of mortality and this sense that time is being compressed. There's a sense of the expansion of time. You read these articles about all the centenarians and about the continually growing life expectancy here and around the world. And at, At the same time, you also realize how fast the last 20 or 25 years went by. And so I think there's this combination of perspective and motivation that I think of in terms of that great slogan of the French Revolution, you know, fraternity, equality, liberty. This is mortality, longevity, and urgency. There's a realization the road doesn't go on forever. You pick up your college yearbook, and not everybody is there. Parents pass away. You read the obituary. Steve Jobs dies. There's a sense that time matters in a way that you're not aware when you're in your teens or 20s or even 30s. And yet the likelihood that there is a stretch of time up ahead, it's almost as if in the past, wisdom was wasted on the old. You know, just at the time you figured out what life was all about, you were too worn out, too rejected to do anything about it. And now you've got 10,000 people a day turning 60 who are reaching this point where they not only have all that benefit of experience, all that time lived, but there's a perspective on life and about what matters most and the time to do something with it. And I think that's really what Hall was talking about when he talked about an Indian summer and about the shadows slanting eastward. It doesn't actually help us at all get past the oxymoronic problem. And when I was writing this book, I was trying to figure out what do you call this stage of life. Hall used the phrase senescence, which is probably explains why 90 years after he wrote his book, we still don't have a name for this period. Other people have talked about mid-course, middle-essence, the third act, the third chapter. I was struggling up against a publishing deadline, and I had no name for this period, and I found myself poised over a laundry hamper with my mother-in-law, who's one of those people who races through the Times crossword puzzle on Sunday and, you know, gets every word, and it's all said and done for in less than an hour. So I said, Donna, what am I going to do? What should I call this period? She said, oh, I'm so glad you asked me. I figured this out long ago. So I said, tell me. I was already moving towards the computer. She said, I'm on my next to last dog. The way she figured it, you know, that she's probably got about 6 years left in her current canine, and then she could get a mid-size. She's in her early 60s, that probably about a 14-year pooch. And at that point, it's not that she's, you know, going to be measured for a casket, but you got to clean up after it and walk it. And so I thought, wow, this is a brilliant, we're used to measuring life in dog years. This is just a new application. But I, in the end, I was guided more by the national discussion that's been happening over the 20s, which I think is a parallel conversation to the one that's occurring in the 60s. There was a MacArthur Foundation commission a few years ago that published a report arguing that the 20s are a new stage of life, which they call emerging adulthood. And so I thought, well, maybe this third phase of adulthood, the period from the 50s through the 70s, could be called encore adulthood. Shakespeare said that there were seven stages of life, and I think as we stretch from 70 to something approximating 50, we can't just stretch those existing stages, and I think we're getting towards something that includes childhood, adolescence, emerging adulthood, midlife, encore adulthood, retirement, and old age. But I think it's going to take more than a vision to realize a life course that makes sense for this century. I'm struck a lot by a comment I heard, read about, of a critique of G. Stanley Hall, who that argued he thought that adolescence was going to take place in Valhalla when, in fact, it occurred in high school. And I think the same caution applies in thinking about how we shape this period. But I'd like to focus as a society on the segment of the population that's planning to contribute in this stage of life, that sees this as a time of productivity, of engagement, of continued growth, and that's also a time to use what you've learned from life, not only to do something that provides personal meaning, but that means something beyond yourself. Marge Piercy, the poet, said, "A pitcher cries for water to carry and a person for work that is real." And I think that's as true at 60 as it is at 20. Studs Terkel said it a different way. He said that Americans get up and go to work every day as much for daily meaning as for daily bread. And he could have easily added daily identity. And so it's no surprise that many people are looking for a new amalgam around work in this stage of life. They need income to be sure, but they're also looking for daily meaning, for daily identity, for work that means something beyond themselves. At Encore.org, we've been calling that an encore career, work in the second half of life that's at the intersection of passion, purpose, and a paycheck. Already 9 million Americans are engaged in these encore careers in the second half of life. 31 million more give top priority to making that transition but are struggling getting from what's last to what's next. It's essentially become a do-it-yourself process for so many people who are trying to get to this aspiration, which is not only going to benefit them, but I think has great potential payoff for the nation. I think as a society, we need to come together and develop better pathways to help people navigate their way into this stage of life. And I think one place to start is with what we do for young people. We have internships for young people. That's one of the best ways for people to find the next phase of work. In fact, Armenia Ibarra, a professor at INSEAD, wrote an insightful book a few years ago, Working Identity, in which she described how people at all stages of life are far more successful if they experiment, if they're able to try on new career roles, than if they just discover their passion. It's a process that's much more likely to be successful if there's an opportunity for trial by error. And after all, that's what we do with internship programs for young people. As I was writing this book, I met people in their 50s and 60s and 70s, one after another, who were essentially sneaking into those internship programs for young people. I met a guy at Yellowstone who'd worked for the public TV station in Boston, had retired from that job, and had always wanted to be a park ranger, couldn't figure out how to get there, so he joined the Student Conservation Association internship program. There wasn't anybody else in his class over the age of 19. I met a woman in Denver whose daughter had gone through Teach for America, and as she watched her daughter teach in a Los Angeles classroom, she was so moved that she applied for Teach for America herself. She was in her late 50s at the time and ended up a year later in a dorm room in July in Houston in 115-degree sweltering temperature, sharing a bathroom down the hall with three 22-year-olds. So it seemed like whether they were burrowing up from the street or rappelling down from the ceiling or sneaking in the side door, there were more and more people who were trying to find these kind of pathways to purpose. We created at Encore.org a fellowship, the Encore Fellowship Program, which was designed to be a front door for many people who wanted to make this passage. It started in Silicon Valley with 10 people who had careers in the corporate sector, wanted to work in the environment, to work with kids in poverty, but had no idea how to actually get there. They spent half time for 9 months, received $25,000 for this fellowship, half from their previous employer, HP was the original sponsor, and half from the nonprofit where they were working. This past fall, Intel announced that every single retirement-eligible employee in the United States could do an Encore fellowship, that they would pay the full $25,000 COBRA coverage, help pay for the administration of the program, and they moved this from a philanthropic initiative to an HR policy. And at a time when all we hear is companies cutting back their HR benefits, here was a new benefit aimed at the reality that so many people who've worked for 25, 30, 35 years are simply not at a point of retirement. And at the same time, they've been so busy doing what they've been doing in midlife that it's hard to really know what's next, that you need to try things on and to have lower barriers to entry to do that. Another idea is school for the second half of life. One of the triumphs of the last quarter century was the invention of lifelong learning through Elder Hostel, OSHA Lifelong Learning Institutes. It's been a huge triumph. And now we've got a well-developed system of education for young people, for older people who are mostly focused on personal development and intellectual stimulation. What we're missing is essentially school for middle people, school for the second half of life. And again, in communities around the country, people are going through the do-it-yourself process. There's been a doubling, for example, of people over 50 going to divinity school since 1990, a phenomenon that Time magazine referred to last year as holy enrollers. But and this has been happening in many other spheres as well. I think we need to do a better job, though, of making those programs efficient, expedited, and affordable. That same Time magazine article I referred to described a woman who'd been a pediatric nurse in Florida who became an Episcopal priest. It cost her $100,000. She had to sell her house. She sold her car. She essentially took a vow of poverty to make it through that period. Why not come up with better ways for people to save for this transition that so many more are going through? There was another article in the Wall Street Journal that described the growing number of boomers who were tapping into their children's 529 accounts to go back to school, whether they were going from being an Episcopal priest to a pediatric nurse or vice versa or some other combination. We've got individual retirement accounts. I'd like to see individual purpose accounts where people save for their own transition. They don't have to go through the route of their children's 529 account. At the policy level, why not make Social Security more flexible? Why not enable people to take a year or two of Social Security in their 50s, for example, to go back to school or to do an Encore fellowship or to do national service for a year, and then have people agree to work an actuarially adjusted period longer on the other end? So I think these are things that we should be experimenting with, trying to develop. And I think at the policy level, we should come up with something that's much more dramatic than even these small experiments that I'm talking about here. You know, when we had millions of soldiers returning from abroad to home after World War II, we created the GI Bill. We did it for them to honor their service to the country, but we also did it for the country because we knew having these individuals struggling at loose ends would be bad for the economy. It would be a source of social conflict. So we created a vast policy innovation called the GI Bill. I think we need something that's a third age bill, an encore bill to help the tens of millions who are crossing different terrain. It's not geographic. It's not from military service to civilian life, but it's really into a stage of life that has no name, that has few pathways and institutions. But at the same way that we were deeply invested in those soldiers finding their footing, the same is true of all these millions and millions of people today who are in this period that's between midlife and anything resembling retirement and old age. And I'd like to see us do it in a way that promoted social mobility. There's a wonderful example, the Troops to Teachers program, which helps, to go back to the GI Bill analogy, which helps mostly sergeants coming back from the Gulf War move into public school teaching. It was created by an 86-year-old retired history professor at Washington University who watched a news account of soldiers coming back from the first Iraq war, sergeants who were having trouble getting their footing in the economy. And he realized at that time we had a shortage of people teaching in urban schools, particularly people of color, and he put two and two together, and it's turned out to be a spectacular program that's helped people get a foothold in a new kind of career and better income than they had when they entered their first career. So many of these individuals were people who went into the military because few other opportunities existed for them. I wrote about a woman who was an assistant principal in Virginia who'd gone into the Air Force at 18 because she couldn't afford college. She was the child of sharecroppers. She ended up through the Troops to Teachers program getting a doctorate in education. And so I think in many ways we can not only help people move into second acts of purpose, but help them move up the ladder as well in this point. I'd like to see us do all these things in part because we have so many people who are at this juncture, because this time is awkward, because it'll be unsustainable as a country to have so many people spending so many years of their lives without gainful employment and opportunities for productivity. The number of people in the middle are simply too small to support all of these people who are in the second half of life. But I hope we can marshal the energy and the creativity to do this equally, because I think there's an extraordinary opportunity here. I think we can turn that longevity paradox into a vast payoff. And I think the analogy is the movement of so many women into new roles in the 60s and 70s. You know, at that point, we were thinking as a society, oh, how, you know, this is going to be a zero-sum proposition. How are we going to accommodate all this talent? They're simply going to displace men, and we're going to end up at the same place as we started, only with a lot of conflict along the way. And now we know that we'd never be competitive as a country without that enormous source of talent. And I think down the road we'll feel the same way about this segment of the population. And I think there are going to be lots of surprises as well. We tend to write off the talent and experience of this group. But even more, we tend to underestimate the creativity and innovation in this segment of the population. There's an economist at the University of Chicago, David Galenson, who studied creativity, and he studied creativity across the life course. He studied, for example, the value of every significant painting that was sold over the last 100 years. And as he looked, he's a macroeconomist, as he looked at the patterns of this artwork, what came across to him more strongly than anything else is that the most valuable work was mostly done by people who were very young or people who were old. And it turns out, according to Galenson, that the reason for that distribution is not that people who are old or people that are young are by their very nature more creative. It has to do with styles of creativity. Conceptual genius tends to bloom early, and experimental genius tends to bloom late. It just takes a long time, if you're an experimental genius, to reach the apex of your productivity. So Cézanne's most valuable work is done in his late 60s. Louise Bourgeois, probably the greatest American sculptor of the last 100 years, at 60 is teaching middle school in Great Neck, New York. She doesn't do her best work until she's 80. And when you think about how much as a society we've tended to think about creativity, innovation, and entrepreneurship as the exclusive province of young people, you know, the Facebook generation, and write people off as they reach this point where they not only have years of potential contribution left, but in many ways some of their best work and some of their most creative work. So I think we're at a point where we can take advantage not only of this vast human capital windfall, but what potentially could be a great wave of innovation. At Civic Ventures, we give out something called the Purpose Prize. Civic Ventures is the name that Encore.org was previously called. Each year, five people get $100,000 prizes. We have 1,200 to 1,500 nominations a year for these awards, and we've given out, in addition to those prizes, 50 fellowships a year just to recognize the top 5% of people who are using their midlife experience really to do their best work. And they're rarely examples of reinvention. They tend to be people who are taking what they've learned from one phase of life and applying it to new challenges and doing so in innovative ways. I think that the two greatest payoffs, though, from making the most of the longevity revolution, and I'll conclude with these thoughts, might be at the cultural level. You know, I talked earlier about mortality, longevity, and urgency, this kind of perfect storm of purpose that so many people in the second half of life end up realizing. But there's a direction to all that purpose, and it's encapsulated in the idea of generativity. Eric Erickson, who was probably the great scholar of the second half of life, said that the hallmark of successful development could be encapsulated in the phrase, "I am what survives of me." As we get closer to our own mortality, we realize that the goal of life is not to try to live forever, not to try to be young forever, to have a second childhood, but to be there to invest in those people who actually are young. And I think as a society, that's been a big part of the American ideal, that we invest in future generations, that future generations will have it better than we did. And I think there's growing concern today in the country that we've lost that. And I think a big part of the reason we've lost that and lost that generative ethos in the country is because we've consigned that our generative heartland, people in this phase of life, to second childhoods. And I think if we did the opposite, if we really fanned generativity, we would not only see much better prospects for young people, but we would give to this next generation and to the generations after that a vision of the second half of life. Remember, these are all the young people who are going to see their 100th birthday. a second half of life that they can really look forward to and invest in. They can recognize early on that there's more than one bite at the apple. And so in many ways, too, I think all of the people who are at this juncture today are like those women in the 60s and 70s who were breaking through to new roles for themselves, but they were also paving possibilities and pathways for all those younger women coming quickly on their heels. And so I think that there is within this zero-sum prospect, in this long gray wave of greedy geezers that we hear about so frequently, the opportunity not only for a massive wave of talent for the country, but for huge opportunity that's going to resonate for years to come. And I'll close with a quote from the mentor of G. Stanley Hall, William James, probably the greatest American philosopher, who said, "The great use of life is to spend it for something that will outlast us." And I can think of no better benediction for everything that we're here to talk about today. Thank you.
We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Mark Friedman. This program has been generously underwritten by Wells Fargo Bank and Ernst & Young. Our thanks to both those corporations. Mark, I know we have questions, and I'd like to invite anyone who has a question to come to the mic so that you can be heard. Who will be first?
Coming, Mark.
Thank you.
It's fascinating having these ideas presented, and I love it. It's working on me. One of the questions that came out of your book was discussion questions that prompted me to think about what's happened recently, and I'd like to get your impressions and take on solutions, possible solutions. Venture capital investors looking at making investments with entrepreneurs. They have said more than one occasion, we need a 20% something face on this investment. We're not interested in you. Do you have any ideas about why that's happening or what kind of solutions we might be able to put forth to break down that resistance?
You know, I think we are at a turning point now. I think what you describe has been the case for many years, despite everything that we hear about the demographics and the size of this population. But I've seen a couple of heartening developments in the past year. One is a venture capital investment in what was called the Encore Career Institute, which has changed its name to Empower Ed, and it's a collaboration of UCLA's continuing education program, the Creative Artists Agency Foundation, entrepreneur Steve Poizner, who ran for gubernatorial nomination a couple of years ago, and that's focused on providing a new kind of education on the iPad for boomers, and particularly focused on careers that have social impact. They're, I believe, going to launch in September. I can't tell you whether they're going to succeed or not, but I was struck by the fact that this was a significant investment that was made, and that it was a collaboration between public and private institutions, a development that I'm much closer to, and that I mentioned earlier, is the film The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. We were in partnership with Participant Media, which was one of the producers of that film. In fact, we've been doing a contest that's a mini purpose prize. It's called the Marigold Ideas for Good Contest, in which people over 50 in communities around the country each month get $5,000 prizes for an idea for social change in their community. And one person each month gets to go with Rhodes Scholar, what was formerly known as Elder Hostel, on a trip anywhere around the world. And there are still a couple months left in that contest, so I encourage anybody to enter. But the reason I bring up Marigold, it was a film that was made for $10 million, and it's made upwards of $125 million so far. And I think it's going to be a game changer for Hollywood, because there's a realization that people in the demographic the movie focus on are interested in stories, and it costs a lot less money to make movies that are about stories. And on the other hand, there's a lot of people in this demographic. So that's a pretty dramatic payoff for the film. And it made me, I was thinking about the film in the context of your comments, because I think time is on our side. At the end of the movie, there's midway through the movie, there's a wonderful scene in which the proprietor of Marigold Hotels, played by Dev Patel, the star of Slumdog Millionaire, a character by the name of Sonny, is accosted by one of the British retirees who's moved there and wants to know why the hotel doesn't look anything like the Photoshopped brochure that that she saw. And he tells her, he said, in India we have an expression that everything works out in the end. So if it hasn't worked out, it's not yet the end.
Our thanks to Mark Friedman, our speaker tonight, author of The Big Shift, for his comments here today. We also thank our audience here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 109th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.